We'll have our talk. Let's start out with John talking about what we look for in a good AME report. Is he here? There he is. And this is going to be just a lot of just direct bullet points. I'm sure we all have the same questions. Do we need to use templates in our QME or in our AME reports? Do we have to cite the literature? Is it important that our report be 30 or 40 pages? Those are the things every time I put out a six-page QME report that I'd like to know the answer to. Okay. Dr. Bloom.
Thank you.
You know, there's no handout on the subject of what's to be in a medical legal report or an AME report from me, but there is law in your handout materials about what the regulations require that you put in to every one of your qualified medical examination reports and agreed medical examination reports. This is kind of a diverse group that's with us today with COA, and that's a good thing. There are people I know here who have been practicing in this field for 30 years and longer, and then there may be a couple of men and women here today who really have never done this before. And so it's a little hard to know where to aim my comments on this or any other subject. I would ask that you experienced folks in the audience kind of bear with me while I go through some of the obvious, more fundamental materials on the bullets of an AME report that I look for. May I just say that it's been a relatively long day on some complex subjects. I think the most didactic process of the day is always your questions. Please belly up to the microphone to ask any and all questions that are up for you whenever they come up. I don't think this particular subject or the marketing concept of AME work that Dana and I are both going to talk about are chock full of chunky, substantive, meaty information. This is very fundamental common sense stuff that's in part regulated and in part common sense. So let me just give you, from my point of view, the elements that I think are important. You obviously are required by regulation to put in a thorough history of the case. I appreciate it on some of my more complicated cases that include two periods of cumulative trauma, one or two specific injuries, and lots of pre-existing stuff, which might include pre-existing industrial injuries. I always appreciate it if you would reflect back to me that you understand the cover letter that I sent to you accompanying the medicals that I sent you as an AME. My cover letter will give you three or four WCAB case numbers, and it will give you a date of loss for each one of the case numbers. I also sent a copy of that funny little document called an application for adjudication of claim, and I will these days, and I have been sending a copy of the DWC-1 form. Sometimes I forget to do that. But my cover letter is going to tell you what are the case numbers, what are the case injuries, and I'm going to really appreciate your showing me when you write your report that you track that. Because that's at the very heart of the concept of causation and little things like the liability as between injuries and possibly serial insurance interests on a single injury. And if you don't do that, and if there's some kind of muddy waters, it's going to tell me, well, either I can send a letter and wait for 16 weeks to get it back, or I can set a deposition. By the way, every time I say, or I have to set a deposition, please do not accept that as an insult or a threat or you're going to get the deposition in case you do things wrong. I hear that so often on these panels. And I got to tell you that you should really embrace the deposition inherently as part of your job as the judge of questions of causation, nature and extent of disability, et cetera. In your role as an AME, you should welcome the deposition and anticipate it. I suppose it's a regular part of your job. So I'd like to see a thorough history from you about my client's significant past. That means, as Mike pointed out, is this a marathon runner? I'd like to see from you a very thorough digest of the medical records that you've looked at and the ones that you've put weight on. Some doctors have assistants that summarize these Beacon's moving storage boxes and sometimes multiple boxes filled with records. I don't blame you a bit for that. You probably didn't want to go to med school to sit around and endlessly review literally 60 pounds of paper per consultation. You've hired other people to summarize it for you. If there's something in your summary that, by the way, if you append, as some of the first-rate AMEs do, a summary or synopsis of all the medical records that you've reviewed, and then also give me the sense of, hey, what is it in there that you thought was significant, that really heads off a lot of monkey motion right at the pass. I don't even bother going in there going, gee, I wonder if he considered this or I wonder if she thought about that. I don't have to do that, and I don't have to go on down there to ask you about whether you did that. So please tell me what you've reviewed. If I've taken the time to send you the records, please take the time to let me know that you've reviewed them. Something that used to be more concerning to me than it is now, a history of present complaints from my client. Now, remember, I'm an applicant's advocate. These days I'm not doing defense work, although who knows, stranger things than that have happened with transitions of who one advocates with. But for the last 26 years or so, I've been working with the disabled only. So I don't, for the disabled. Can you say disability? Actually, you don't have to say disability anymore. All you have to say is impairment now. But in any event, so in the recent past, in my experience, I've spent less time paying attention to my own clients' complaints and more time paying attention to your recitation of what you think the authentic complaints are. You are allowed to interpolate, but it would be wise for you, in my opinion, to list a series of complaints and problems that my client tells you he or she is suffering from. Just show me that you sat there and that you listened. By the way, what Dr. Mandel said is absolutely true. There has never been an agreed medical examination yet that's taken place in my practice where a client did not come back and tell me, this AME listened to everything I said. He really knows what he's doing. And you know, and they will say that usually before the report comes back, sometimes even after the report comes back. So something that they will always get the lawyer caught in the crossfire on is your recitation of the subjective factors of problems that my client is suffering from. If you don't list what the client tells you they're suffering from, you've got to show me that you recognize that the injured worker has one series of complaints. I'm letting you know from this dais today that I understand that you may have a very different take on what their subjectives are. Now, I used to make more of a big deal about the subjectives than I'm going to be in the future, because in the future I have this idea that subjectives aren't going to count for a whole heck of a lot on the compensable outcome of my client's entitlements. So in years to come, I'm not going to be paying as much attention to this subject as I have up until now, but I got to tell you, my practice has liberated untold millions of dollars from the insurance industry this year and every year in the last 28 years on subjectives. So it's not an incidental item that I look at, because right now, the way the labor code reads, applying the present schedule for aiding permanent disabilities, subjective factors count for a lot. And judges can look at your work restriction, and even if there seems to be some enormous incongruity between a de minimis work restriction and a large characterization of subjective factors, judges can and often do make findings on solely the subjective factors. So I got to see it in there. Now, if you want to keep me off your back, and I don't know why you'd want me to be off your back. I kind of think my depositions are a lot of fun. But if you want to keep me off your back, and these guys, I might add, these guys are a lot, they have much more fun than I do, then you've got to explain why your interpretation of subjective factors is different from my clients. And actually, if I read the tea leaves correctly on members of the panel to my left and to my right, you're going to have to explain why they're the same also. Let us know. This person is inherently incredible. He had a cervical collar and a cane in my office and could barely get up and down from the examination table, but I watched him walk into his Porsche in the driveway after the examination, and the cervical collar came off and was thrown in the back of the Porsche, and he leaped over the unopened door into the saddle and drove off into the sunset. So you can tell me stuff like that in the report. It's okay to say that. sometimes AMEs, I notice, avoid the M word, malingering, in the report. Some of the more sophisticated evaluators who read your reports know that we know what you mean if you don't use the M word. There's a big discrepancy between the presentation by the injured party and your findings. I mean, you can make that be known without throwing mud pies. And I think that injured workers just raise a ruckus when mud pies are thrown, even if they should be thrown. A little bit of diplomacy in the mud pie subject matter goes a long, long way to keeping damage control going from my client's point of view. Because your report, unless it's a psychiatric evaluation, when I'm the attorney, your report goes right over to my client and generally over to the primary treating physician. And the first thing I say to the client is, please take a look at this AME report and let me know if there are any material misstatements of fact, any misstatements that you would like to correct and you would like me to bring to his or her attention. So show me what you've got. Keep it diplomatic. Notice that the injured worker is just a human being and has feelings and will have those feelings react in a very proactive way on the attorney if it's not handled in a nice way. All right, so let's get to work restrictions. Work restrictions up until now have counted for an awful lot in my book because it's one of the factors that we rate permanent partial disability on. You've got to be explicit up until the implementation of the new rating schedule. And actually, now that the AD's office is now promulgating the new PR4s, as I understand it, you're still going to need to talk work restrictions in order to help with collateral issues of return to work in this 15% augmentation or diminution factor on an accommodated duty position that'll hang in the balance of what you describe as work restrictions. Be mindful that when you use work restrictions, it could cost that injured worker his or her job. I don't know how to phrase that, and I'm not sure I understand all the implications of this yet. It may be that there are some on our panel and in our audience that understand it better than I. I'm hanging back at the moment on this subject, but I have a feeling that under the new system where there is virtually no, for all practical purposes, no vocational retraining, if your work restrictions are way out there, since it doesn't create a compensable consequence, the injured worker doesn't get paid any money for it, I'm not really going to want to see all that much because it could cost my clients their job in an accommodation if the employer sees that he or she has to be accommodated tremendously. So I'm going to hang back on that subject, but you are going to need to be articulate about work restrictions for this accommodation feature of the PR4s. Prophylactic work restrictions are valuable on that same PR4 subject, but they don't really rate to the new rating principles. But until the new year, as you continue writing your reports, I want to see your prophylactic work restrictions. If he or she should not do X, Y, and Z so as to avert aggravating or accelerating the known condition, please let me know that. And you can let me know that it is partially, that your work restrictions are partially prophylactic. The use of the phrase, this work restriction is partially prophylactic, actually probably shuts me down from 10 or 15% of my deposition work. If you don't say this is partially prophylactic, I'll go down there to find out about your work restrictions. If you do say that it's partially prophylactic in nature, that cuts out a whole area of my normal cross-examination for deposition. That's pretty much it. The whole emphasis of the last 5 hours in our discussion today is the foundation for my last bullet, and that is you must explain yourself. Whenever you express an opinion, you will rise to the top of the AME category of who's desirable in the community when you repeatedly use an explanation behind every conclusion. Your report may be 5 pages, or more likely 12 pages. Some of the reports I get from AMEs are 30 pages. My teeth start chattering at 60 pages. I sometimes get 100 pages. I don't need 100 pages. Actually, I used to be an editor of a newspaper, and I used to just slash and burn. And if, you know, sometimes less is more. Say it a little more succinctly. Busy judges don't want to read 100 pages. Busy lawyers don't want to read 100 pages. You're not impressing anybody with a long report. If you can't get out from under 30 pages, okay, we'll understand it. But for every conclusion that you reach, there may be 15 or 20 in the form of a 12 or 20-page report. Please give me an explanation that rationalizes your conclusion. And just in case you really want to ring my chimes and just keep me shut up, give me facts in support of the reasons supporting your conclusions. Lawyers deal with facts. And you know what? One of the most effective techniques that I've learned over the 30 years of kind of bumping my way through the hallways of the courthouse and the cross-examination process is asking you experts to please give me the facts that support your opinion. Just the facts. I don't really want to hear about your 30 or 35 years of experience with other patients. I really don't want to hear about that x-ray up there on the wall as much as facts. If you're going to cite an x-ray as a fact in support of your right hip opinion, I wasn't cross-examining Dr. Suhi today, but if I were, I'd have asked him, well, all right, 50% of this compensable disability just went out the window due to pre-existing arthritis. Did you get a chance to look at the opposite hip for arthritic changes? Because I didn't see that in the summary, and frankly, he didn't lay that thing out for the purpose of a cross-examination. But anytime you write a report, it's going to be subject to cross-examination. You should welcome it and write it in anticipation of our cross-examination. It doesn't have to be a torture chamber, but if you're going to attribute disability to a right shoulder, a right elbow, and say that there are pre-existing factors of pathological changes that are evidenced at the time of injury on the affected member, you better darn well take a picture of the opposite member or the opposite joint to show me that there is a comparable amount of arthritic changes. And if there is, how come there isn't 50% of the disability in the opposite member? And if there isn't, then probably you're right, 50-50 to the affected joint. Do you see what I'm getting at? You need to give me nuggets of fact. Because actually, after a while, what we in the cross-examination business do is we just look for that. I go right to the facts. If I don't like your conclusion, you know, you and I are allowed to disagree, but I'm, you know, sometimes charged with the responsibility of asking you to rationalize it. If you can rationalize it, then, you know, I'm swinging in the air and the ball's going and the umpire's going, you're out. But if you're throwing pitches at me and I'm swinging the bat, and you can't give me facts in support of the rationale in support of your conclusion, then I'm going to take that to the work comp judge, and I'm going to argue that this is not an enforceable apportionment even under the new system. So all of that can be headed off right there in the initial report. I don't want to have to work with a 60-page report. You can do it in 12 or 15 or 20. I'm a confirmed anti-intellectual. I don't need the 30-page variety anymore. Just give me the facts that support your conclusions. Those are the bullets for a report writing. These are not nuggets of gold. You all know about this. It's just kind of the obvious. If there are any questions about that, I'd be glad to take them. Otherwise, we'll go on to marketing. Yes, doctor?
Jim Reynolds, I'm a spine surgeon. In the spine world, there's an FCE, or functional capacity evaluation. Does that have any value to you in the present system, and will that have any value in the future?
That's a great question. I love functional capacities, and I actually use functional capacity evaluators. Actually, up where I live in the wine country, there aren't that many options on who does functional capacity testing. I think functional capacity testing is virtually the whole shooting match, because you and I can sit around and speculate all we like about factors interpreted from behavior, but you know the bottom line is if they can perform in a functional capacity test, that's very significant evidence. Some of the more conservative elements argue to me that functional capacity testing is really a subjective test. It can be faked or frauded or malingered through. But we're all kind of grasping at straws in this world. We look to you experts to call the shots for us. The judges also cannot make rulings without your expertise. You should consider using functional capacity tests on the current disability system. Now, on the new rating system, I believe that range of motion is largely the call of the day. And some others here more familiar with how to use the AMA guides than I might agree with me that functional capacity testing might also be useful there, but it doesn't fit squarely into the chapters that I've read from the AMA guide, 5th edition. What do you think about that?
Functional capacity evaluations are, in my judgment, useless to determine disability. They're useful to determine ability. The problem is that from the standpoint of assessing disability, the person goes into a functional capacity evaluation with the purpose of demonstrating that they're not able to function. It's relatively easy to show you're not able to function in the functional capacity evaluation if that's your goal. If the goal of the functional capacity evaluation is to demonstrate that you're able to do something, you have a particular job you want to go back to, and you want to demonstrate the capacities to go back and perform that job, I think then it can be a very useful assessment. I know the IMC several years ago considered whether to put functional capacity evaluations into the standard evaluation and decided not to, because for purposes of determining disability, they are inherently unreliable. And they're too much they're too much dependent upon the individual assessor, and I rarely ever see assessors ever commenting on whether somebody actually makes a full effort in their evaluation.
You know, I don't want to belabor the point. There are different points of view on this, but let me just say this. We all at this dais right now try cases to judges. If a judge wants to make a finding in favor of one of my clients and I give that judge a basis of evidence, whether these functional capacity tests are pristine and objective or largely subjective, it still gives a judge something to hang his or her hat on if they want to find in favor of my client. If they don't want to find in favor of my client in the face of functional capacity testing, they can agree with Jake and his client that they're meaningless. I don't happen to think that they're meaningless. I pump my clients up to use their best efforts, but ultimately, I think if you offered them a million... Did you ever watch that Monday night show, All the Bugs You Can Eat? I forget what the name of the show is, Fear Factor. I mean, if you hold enough cash up, people can and do almost anything. So if you hold $1 million up, maybe they'll perform better on the functional capacity test, but unfortunately, that's not in the cards. We can't rig it that way. All we have is what we've got, and, you know, I wish that we had a lot of more objective testing. I like functioning capacity tests. When I use those, though, some of these guys are going to try to negate it when they argue to the judge.
Yes, some might say you do, in fact, hold $1 million up in front of the applicant to do the functional capacity test, and you dare him to fail it for money. That's the problem with functional capacity assessments.
For disability.
For disability. Let me kind of slightly disagree with John on a couple of minor points on what you're looking for in an AME report. Dr. Mandel probably has thrown up 1,000 times in the last 25 years reading my commentary in my letters that I write, because I've used the same phrase for 25 years. Consistently reproducible, objectively verifiable, anatomically valid. That's the litany that I've used for 25 years. Is that what you've been reading from me?
It is.
To the point where it's nauseating, but that's what we want under this new regime. That's what defendants have always wanted. Take the subjectivity out and give us the medical decision-making based upon hard medical findings, not subjective complaints by the patient. Tell us when the complaints by the patient are not borne out by consistently reproducible, anatomically valid, orthopedic or neurologic findings on examination. Don't, please, don't, underscore, don't, for God's sakes, don't get in a fight in writing with another physician and call him a milk cow. don't do it. It does both of you a disservice. It lowers you to their level, and it raises them to yours. Don't get in such a name-calling fight. You know, if he's that bad, we all know it. Just point out your areas of medical disagreement and leave the fact that he's a milk cow out of your report. We don't care that he's a milk cow because we already know it. Number two, in terms of the AME report, shorter and clearer is better. Appending 5,000 pages of medical literature is of no significant benefit to us. Cite the literature if you need to in order to support your opinion if the answer is not obvious and generally accepted in the medical community. If it's a proposition that's obvious and generally accepted in the medical community, you don't need to append all this crap to your reports. Don't bother. Next, if the patient comes into you for an upper extremity evaluation and has a pinch of one and a grip of four, but tied his own shoes and put on his own pants, don't be so silly as to think that that is a consistent finding that you should accept. Let us know that you're not so stupid as doctors to think we're so stupid as readers that you can say this guy's problems are valid when he drove his own car to you, put on his own pants, changes his own oil, but has a pinch of one and a grip of four. It can't be. Be consistent. Tell us what you find. You don't have to call him a name. You don't have to call him a malingerer. John says that word doesn't belong. It doesn't. Tell us what you found and give us your best medical decision-making and judgment on what you found that's within your medical decision-making. If it's not a medical condition, don't describe it. Don't tell us about it. Don't refuse to tell us the truth and instead punt him over to the psychiatric or pain management so we can make him a drug addict and shorten his life with 25 years of horrible drugs that do nothing but line the pockets of people who prescribe them. Tell us what you really think and don't punt them away. If you don't think they need that kind of therapy, tell us that you don't think this is medically appropriate under this circumstance. If you do think it's appropriate for the day after the injury to put an indwelling morphine pump in that knee that has no objective findings, tell us that too, and you'll never get another AME case again. As John said, there is a lot of common sense in this, but you don't need to call names, you don't need to get in fights, and you just need to basically tell us what the facts are, tell us the reason for your opinion. If there are scans, reference the date of the scan. If there's an x-ray, reference the date of the x-ray. Do you have to summarize every letter in every report and every record that you've got? For God's sakes, no. That's the defense attorney's obligation to scour those records to find the gems. It's the applicant's attorney's obligation to send you the pile he's never looked at and hope you never find the information in it. It's the defense attorney, because he's not paid by the hour. He's not going to do that. That's us. We're going to be the ones who have read every single one of those records. We're going to file and serve the important excerpts, and that's when the applicant's attorney gets educated. The reason Mr. Bloom and the applicant's attorneys want to know that you've read the file is so that they don't have to spend 25 hours to figure out if you're right or you're wrong, because it's going to be in your reports. They're not paid by the hour to spend that kind of time. We are. If it's a 104, so are you. Don't be bashful. The best part about being an AME, this is the secret of the ages, the best part about being an AME, we don't really look that closely at the bill. You know why? Because we can't do without you.
We just don't pay it.
We can't do without you. So if you tell us it took you 12 hours, and we look at that 52 pounds and we say, could that possibly have taken 12 hours? Our answer is always, absolutely, dear client, pay the bill. I get the bill with the report usually. It also goes to a review company. And I, the moment I get the report and the bill, I write to my client that instant and I fax it to him and I say, this is a good report. Although the time spent is long, it's a lot of records, it's well worth it. We don't have to take his depo. Every issue is covered. Pay the damn fee. That's what I leave out the word damn. Pay the fee. That's what I tell him. If you then send it back to me and say, did I use the term rat bastard earlier? I'll use it again. Those rat bastards cut my fee. 80% of the time, I'll cut you a check for the difference. 80% of the time. And I'll call my client and I'll say, you are, cut the AME's fee. And they'll say, oh God, I can't override you are. Would you cut the check and just put it on your bill? Done. I do it all the time. What we want is thoroughness. We're willing to pay you to be thorough. We're not going to going to meticulously try to find some excuse not to pay an AME's bill like we do for an adversary. You're not our adversary. You are our friend. Treat us like your friend. Because we can't exist in this system without AMEs. It will grind to an absolute halt. If you have a problem and you need more information, ask us. One of the things I generally put in an AME letter is, "Dear doctor, if you feel you need to arrange for any diagnostic test in order to come to a fully informed and reliable opinion, you arrange for it and it will be paid under the official medical fee schedule." That's in my AME letter. The applicant's attorney's QME does that. Boy, they do that at their risk. AMEs, you need a test, by God, you've got it. Under AMA impairment guidelines, you need a test, by God, you better do it, because otherwise it's going to make your report less valuable, inadmissible, incomplete, etc. So whereas we may fight to the death to stop that X-ray by you as a treating doctor, we're going to fight to the death to make sure you get to do an MRI, a CT, an EMG, a nerve conduction study, and any other kind of test you want as an AMA impairment evaluator, because your value of report and the reliability of your rating is only as good as the objectives and test data that you can provide us to support it. Seems like a stupid thing, doesn't it? That as the treating doctor, we won't give you the same diagnostic threshold of availability that will be as an AMA impairment rating doctor, but it's a fact of the matter. It's not necessarily smart, but it is what we do. We're not your enemy, though, the lawyers, as you're an AME. We are your enemies when you're a QME, and most of you, as of January 1, will not be doing much by way of QMEs. Help us out. Make yourselves available. Get your reports to us timely. Make them thorough. Make them consistent. Make them common sense. If there's a threshold question, address it. If there are issues that require expert research, do the research. If they don't require expert research and they're issues of common sense, just answer the question without the research, and we'll all get through this period of about 18 months that's going to be difficult to adjust to.
If I can add a couple more quick questions. Very good comments in large. I've said this, I'll say it again, to read the letters that we send, because remember why you are being asked to do your report. Sometimes it's on all issues. Sometimes it's on one issue. Sometimes you need to go into all of those medical records. Sometimes you don't. It depends on what we're talking to you about. Sometimes there's no dispute on periods of temporary disability. Sometimes that's the only dispute. We're going to try and tell you what you're looking for. Please make sure you do. The second thing is, I have seen 30, 40, 60, 80, 100 page reports that are very, very long until it gets to the conclusions, and then it's one paragraph. And so I've got volumes of information that really help me in no way whatsoever, and when it means something, there's no substance. And that did not help me at all. Where I need your detail, where I need a little bit of meat, is when you get to those conclusions. And when you look at why are we coming to you, is it about whether this injury is industrial or not? Because if it is, then you better explain why you found it was or it wasn't. And it better not be a conclusory statement. You should refer to the deposition transcript if we gave it to you, or refer to the history that you took, or refer to the medical records so we can connect the dots. If we're talking about permanent disability, especially under the new system, under AMA guides, it's all about measurements. Well, you better make sure you did the right ones. And for those who don't know AMA, you're going to have to learn them, because we are all, as attorneys, going to be asking, did you do all of the possible ratings that you could possibly do, and how well did you do them? And some of them give you discretion to assign percentages based on certain findings. And if there's a 30-point spread for you to decide whether something's a 10 or a 30, you're going to have to tell us why you said 10, 20, or 30. And again, there's no science to that, but an explanation will help us. The other thing to remember is, if you give us an explanation, that is the fodder for which depositions will be taken. So if you say, I found the injury was work-related because of these three facts, and the defense wants to challenge you, they're going to look at trying to attack those three facts. You can imagine, if your deposition is taken, that and most of you as AMEs know when your deposition is being taken, why your deposition is being taken. So if you know there's a fight on AOE, COE, be as thorough as you can, because the worst that we can do is take your deposition, have you change your opinion. You know, there are three reasons you list, and we show that for whatever reason, those three reasons aren't correct. You didn't have an accurate history. The medical records weren't complete, whatever. And then you say, oh, okay, and after that, you change your mind again and come up with some new theory that was never articulated before. Think it through. Be as detailed as you can so we can come in, and if there are reasons that your conclusions were incorrect that we can attack, then that will probably or should probably lead to a change in those conclusions. And it's okay to admit that your information was inaccurate. I mean, if you base your opinion on a work history that ends up being incorrect, and we show, or we ask you by hypothetical, gee, if we or a finder of fact establishes that the three premises upon which you based your conclusions are incorrect, then you, I think, have to say, well, then I better change my mind. There's nothing worse than a doctor who won't change his mind even when all of the logic or the premises that they base their conclusions on are no longer found to be valid. A few other comments. One of the big issues that comes up is whether the amount of disability the person has is inconsistent with their work. And it's ironic because we have a lot of people who are hurt who they come to you want to tell you how badly hurt they are because they want to get as much as they can within the system. But if they push too far, they end up with a level of disability that is inconsistent with their job, and they find themselves out of work. And all of a sudden, that extra $5,000 that they could have gotten in permanent disability pales in comparison to being unemployed and being unemployable. So most people, you've got to take a look. If there is a chance to get a job description, get a job description and get a history and take a look. And there is a section in your report where you should comment on whether this person can go back to work. So you can say, even though I have found X percentage of impairment per the AMA guidelines, I have reviewed this person's job description and these are their duties and I believe this person can or cannot perform those functions, depending on whether the person can or can't. If the person's gone back to work and says, you know, my God, I really want to keep working, and you believe it's that they're able to, make sure you comment on that. Conversely, if this is a career-ending injury, and you don't have someone who's just saying that, but you really believe this person's job is incompatible, then you ought to explain that as well. Again, give us the explanations. Don't make conclusory statements. If there's any area where you need to run on a little, run it on in the conclusions and organize it. You know, think this through of what are your points that you're trying to say. And one of the things you might want to look to, when you're writing your answers, look at the questions. If my questions are, tell me about this, 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 and this, it's helpful when your report says, in response to these questions, here's answers to questions 1, 2, 3, and 4. You don't have to structure it that way, but make sure your last check mark before you send it off to dictation or printing is, did I answer each of the questions that I was given, and do they make sense? And to the extent they do and you have, there will be less need, not no need, but less need for follow-up. Dick?
Just a comment and some questions. I hope that the attorneys here understand how difficult it's going to be for us to truly do exactly what you've asked for, be thorough, be complete, be anatomic, be consistent. All of those things are good requests. We would like to honor them and then throw things at us like the AMA guidelines for impairment, because let us say an individual falls down and breaks his wrist and has a post-traumatic arthritis of his wrist despite all of our efforts to make him perfect like new. And he has a range of motion where he goes up about 60 degrees and he goes down about 60 degrees, but he only has a grip strength of 20 pounds, and he says, it hurts me. That's why I don't grip more. I can't grip anymore. It's 20 pounds and that's it. Now, we can give you a much more thorough report if we tell you that, okay, here's his range of motion, here's his grip strength, he's not missing any parts, but I did something extra. Maybe you didn't authorize it, because whether you authorize it or not, we can do it if we're not caring about whether we get paid for it, and sometimes I do things like that, and I don't have a problem with that. So we do an arthrogram of his wrist, and we put in some Conray and carbocaine into his wrist, and we flow the dye over the surface of the wrist. We anesthetize the wrist. We tell him to grip the grip meter, and now he's got 65 pounds of grip strength. Now, I can report to you that he has 20 pounds of grip strength, but I give you a better report if I can tell you I believe that is truly impaired by his having pain when he attempts to grip, and here's why. I put the dye in. The dye identified the surface of the joint as being irregular. The dye was mixed with local anesthetic, so his grip strength tripled, and that's one of the reasons that I believe the way I do. It may not be in the AMA guidelines, but I would think you would get a better report. I mean, you could handle the situation better if you had more information.
Do you do that, Dick, when an AME comes to you? Do you ask the patient permission to do that?
Sometimes.
How do you guys feel about
if
asking
I think
a patient?
I'm trying
you're,
to.
You're almost treat. You're doing something invasive there. How do you guys feel about that?
If I feel there's confusion and I can help, I'll ask to do it.
Well, no, it's a good idea, but I'm just.
Nobody.
If you're going to. Go ahead.
I can't speak for everyone up here, but certainly. Defense perspective is we want to know the truth. We want to get down to the reality of it. So if you feel that that process is going to give you a better understanding of the true level of disability or lack thereof, we're all for it. I don't think, certainly none of the clients I would be dealing with would have any issue with you doing that in an effort to find out more. And certainly I would be going to bat. If you wanted to do that and you had concerns about whether it's authorized, I'd be calling my client saying, we're absolutely going to be authorizing that. The more information you can get more accurately, the better.
So all we really want to do is give you a better picture of what's going on. But we are impaired ourselves somewhat by the rigidity of the AMA guidelines.
And I guess what we'd say is you are obligated to give us impairment per AMA, and that probably is the most that we're going to get. But, you know, there are lots of other unknowns out there. Under the old workers' comp system, the system was supposed to measure ability to compete in the labor market. The new system is supposed to measure a different thing, and it's supposed to measure sort of loss of earnings capacity and impairment. So if you give us stuff that isn't AMA, it may be fodder for us to work with. I don't know if I will be able to turn that into something else or not, but if you think it's relevant, give it to us. And we'll talk about it, and we'll see. And it may lead to another set of questions. It may lead us to, you know, if there's an excitement about this, and I'm not enthused, but if there is an excitement about this new system, this is how new law gets made. So your report might be the genesis for a case that changes how things are done. I don't know if it will or it won't, but if you think there's something that's relevant that needs to be said, if you think that AMA is accurate to a point but misses something, tell us. I don't know what we'll do with it. Mike, what do you think?
Okay. Mike, about AMA?
Yeah, I agree with Alex on this to a point. And the point for me stops when you start blathering about the unfairness of the system and railing against the criteria. Don't go there, because if you ever want to poison pill yourself as an AME, don't rail against the system. Just try to stay as objective as you can be. If you think the AMA impairment rating does not accurately in this particular circumstance reflect the level of impairment, there are ways to describe that without going to war with the legislature over the issue of whether the whole AMA system and how much we pay you, and by the way, how long we require you to do this, that, or the other. It doesn't help your credibility. It doesn't help us for you to go off on the system, on a diatribe. Tell us as succinctly as you can what you think in this particular case produces the need for some other test or for some different approach. If that means you think it ought to go more toward the pain side, if that means you think it ought to go more to the neurologic side, if you think that means in this case it ought to be rated more on the vascular side, if you think on the... Tell us that, but don't go off on the system, because that's not going to help us.
Some people have planes to catch, so we're just going to have to go along. And these the lawyers will be here afterward for any brief questions you have. What I'd like to do here, because we've really heard a lot from John about not direct marketing, but in his AME excellent talk. So let's do this. Let's have Dana Miller give us a talk right now. On marketing your practice, how to reach out to lawyers morally, ethically, legally. And then I'd like to just go down the line, and maybe you could each have any additive comments to what he has to say. And when we get to right here, we'll be done, and thank you for coming. Dana?
Sure.
How do I let you guys know that I've been a defense QME, and I'd really like to work with you, and I'd like you to give me a try? on doing this kind of work.
I'll try and make this brief. I know it's been a long day. First of all, in at least in Northern California, where we are at, any of the established AMEs, the good quality AMEs, it's going to take anywhere between 4 months in the very low end up to about 8 or 9 months to get into them. Okay. There is a huge need for AMEs now under the old system. Now, when you consider the fact that there are no more QMEs and those prior QME-type assessments are going to be funneled into AMEs, the need is only going to be that much greater. So, following some of the suggestions that the other attorneys up here have given you about writing a good report is, if you have a good quality report that is the foundation for becoming a very quick rising star as a potential AME. We're starving for quality AMEs. If you want it, you can get it fairly easily. Now, quality aside is a premise. You just have to have that, obviously, and all those factors are considered. Then there's the more pragmatic. How do you get known? Well, like any new business, you got to put a lot of time into it that you otherwise might not put into it, which probably has nothing to do with practicing medicine. It's getting out there. There are a lot of organizations, North Bay Workers' Comp Association, South Bay Workers' Comp Association, CWCI, DVICA. These are all workers' comp associations in various geographic areas, which are nonpartisan organizations made up of workers' comp professionals. And they usually have monthly meetings, luncheons, discussions, seminars, and the like. If you want, I can't tell you how valuable it is for a person to be able to put a person's face to a name. The second they meet you, there's automatically a connection that, oh, okay, now I know what he looks like. I've chatted with him. He doesn't have seven arms and is this weird person way up high. He's a regular human being, and I'm going to trust him more. You get more known, more familiar to the people who are involved in that community. It works wonders. You may also offer contact any member of the board of directors for any of those associations who are always looking for people to talk about a certain topic to ask if they'd be willing to have you come and talk about back injuries or thoracic outlet syndrome or whatever it is that your specialty is. You'll get better known. Then they're going to start sending you more work or giving you a try. If you're a treater or you're involved in a case and you're not in an AME capacity on that specific case, giving them a call about a particular patient, you got this concern, actually picking up the phone and speaking in person to the individuals involved is incredible for us because it lets us know you actually care enough about what you're doing to pick up the phone, not just sit behind a dictation machine. A lot of this seems very common sense, but before becoming an attorney, I was an adjuster and I went to these functions. It really does play a very big role in separating you from all the others out there. During those functions, you have the opportunity to actually explain, say, yeah, well, you know, with the new system and all that, and you're up on the law and you realize that AME is where it's at, and letting them know you're out there and you want to be able to be used as an AME. It doesn't hurt to let them know that. And that's all I have to say about that. Just like any business, getting your name out there, it's not going to happen overnight. It's a cumulative process. Just going once or twice isn't going to do it, but doing it cumulatively in conjunction with the quality of your reports, you're going to start booking very quickly.
Yeah, and what one kind of small point I wanted to make along those very same lines is if you do a bad job, it spreads like wildfire through the industry. It's a small community. So make sure that you know what you're talking about before you go out and try to market yourself to the claims industry, because frankly, most of the claims people know more than you know and know more than I know about workers' comp. They live, eat, and breathe it all day long. thousands and thousands of cases. So make sure you're right before you go market yourself. And when you do an actual case, if you want to be an AME, make sure you've been objective and have done it correctly, because good work travels at 50 miles an hour. Bad work travels at 100 miles an hour, and it's a small community.
Can I ask a question? Oftentimes, QMEs come directly from the carriers. No attorneys, at least, are involved. Am I to understand that AMEs come only from attorneys?
That is absolutely correct. An unrepresented injured worker may not agree to an AME. AME is only an animal that exists in a represented case on both sides. At least on the applicant's side.
But I understand. But all referrals will be through attorney's office and not direct from carriers?
Well, that isn't necessarily so, because a carrier can agree to an AME directly with an applicant's attorney without defense counsel. So it's possible the carrier will set up with you as well as the applicant's attorney's office.
Okay.
You know, I actually think Mr. Mark's comment is an interesting one about how good work travels at 50 miles an hour. And the converse is that bad work travels like lightning. That may be true, but you have never had a stronger calling to become a report writer and the judge of medical and functional questions than you have right now. There's a whole new system ushering into the California world of work comp, and you are right in the middle of the fray. You probably went through graduate school and medical college and chiropractic school and all the other graduate studies that you've pursued through time to put yourself in the midst of the fray, because you're gifted. You are probably no less gifted with 10 and 20 and 30 years experience under your belt now. We need you more than ever. So when Mike says, oh, no, don't market yourself until you really know your stuff, well, of course we want you to know your stuff. But, you know, you got to start somewhere, and this is as good a time as any that I can think of for you to start right now. And sometimes, you know, when you're getting off to a start, it's a slow start. And you may make some mistakes. Mr. Marks will be there to help you through those mistakes and correct them. And I'm sure he won't promote those million-mile-an-hour words and phrases about your work on that case. You got to start somewhere. Come on. This is the time to start. We really do need to look to your expertise. And thanks very much for being here so astutely all day long.
I'm just going to make a few more comments. I think there's sort of three types of doctors in our audience. You have the AMEs who are well-established, well-known, and who are booking 14,000 months in advance. You have people who have been used in the past primarily as QMEs and are identified in our community primarily as a defense QME or an applicant's QME. And you may have some new blood, sort of unknowns, who are interested in whether to put their toe in the water and whether this is a place to come. My first opinion is I think there is, for you doctors, an incredible opportunity as the system goes on, because the demand for your services is going to only go up. The next question is, for the AME who is already established, they often ask me, well, I don't have a problem getting business, but, you know, what do I do about the two people who have just joined my group who, you know, everyone's calling to use me, but nobody wants to use them. And for those who are established AMEs, you have an important role to mentor and oversee and promote the new people you are bringing in, because you know that you can't handle any more business, but you have associates who can. And they, to have any credibility, need to be able to put out good product and have trust from both sides. Your lending your name to these people will make a difference, but do remember, if you start lending your name to these people, they've got to produce the same caliber of report, both in terms of fairness and in terms of detail and quality, that you're producing. Speaking for the unknown potential AME, I think there is a couple of logical things to do in terms of marketing. If you can hitch your wagon to an established AME and do some joint marketing, that's a step. There is the outreach that we've talked about. There are applicants associations and defense organizations. But a lot of this comes down to personal relationships, and we do talk amongst ourselves. It is a small community, and word does travel. And one of the most useful things a person can say when asked is, you know, because one of the questions I'm going to ask a name of someone I've never seen before is, who's used you before? And if you give me three names of applicants' attorneys, we're going to call and chat and talk amongst each other. And I'm sure the defense lawyers do the same. And they're going to say, yeah, the person was fair, or no, the person wasn't, or whatever. It makes a difference. Again, from the defense side, there's more flexibility. Defense can roll the dice and say, let's try 15 cases with these five doctors and test the waters. For the applicants, each case is an individual. Each individual is important. And it's much harder for us to take that leap forward to try an unknown. And so, you know, by necessity, we have to expand that pool because the alternative is the random choice, which we don't want, or waiting indefinitely for one of the well-known folks. And so this is sort of a message also to those QMEs who are perceived as strongly liberal or strongly conservative. If you want to survive in the new system, you can't be what you used to be because the business will either never come, or if it does, it'll go away very quickly. So you've got to move into the middle, and the question is, will people be willing, you know, will defense lawyers be willing to trust a lawyer, a doctor that used to be seen as applicant, or vice versa? I know from my standpoint, we have to. We have to open the doors and try cases, and what we will probably do is start with people with fairly clearly industrial injuries, so there's not a big fight on whether it's work-related or not, and take some of our least controversial cases and try them with doctors who have shown some interest. And ways of reaching out are either coming to associations or, you know, having a meeting. You can't do it in an individual case because that's an AME and you can't have ex parte communications, but you can participate in social gatherings. You can market and meet people. And if at some point someone decides to try you, all it takes is one. And if a defense-oriented doctor can start rattling off, gee, the following applicants' lawyers have used me as AMEs, call them, and those lawyers will then say, yes, you know, we think these are fair reports under the new system. That's the new leaf of the new practice. It's happened in the past where people who are known to be defense become, you know, more liberal or vice versa. So there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, I think I actually just have two comments to make. First of all, sort of building on what Alex said, I think if you're somebody relatively new to the system, or if in effect you're trying to reinvent yourself into a more middle-of-the-road mode, I think developing personal relationships with a number of people within the system, particularly applicant and defense attorneys, who can look at your work product and give you some feedback and tell you, this is good product, this is bad product, here's what I think you ought to be doing that maybe you're not doing, help with your format in terms of the report, but also ultimately looking at it and saying, your reports make sense and they're internally consistent, and the reports that people ought to be willing to accept, or they may tell you, you know, you've really got a problem because these reports don't match up. But if you can get somebody to help in terms of mentoring you, whether it's a physician, as Alex mentioned, or feedback from attorneys, and I've given that on many occasions to many physicians, some are in the audience, in terms of just trying to help people establish how do you go about doing this stuff, what's an acceptable range of results when you do a medical legal evaluation. Also, I would think that any time you have a chance to do an unrepresented applicant QME evaluation, that is a potential opportunity to generate a report that people can look at and say, this guy knows what he's doing. I looked at this report, and it's internally consistent. I think it's important that a doctor demonstrate a healthy skepticism in doing the evaluation. That doesn't mean you make the injured worker prove to you that they are disabled, but keep in mind, when they walk into your office, that they're for a reason. Usually it's to figure out how much they're going to be compensated, and that, you know, for all, you know, purely human, normal reasons, skews some of the results that you're going to get. So you need to look at what they're doing and look at the evaluation and simply, you know, assess it from the standpoint of being a scientist. Is what they're telling me consistent? Can I make sense of it? If it doesn't make sense, and you've got to explain it in some fashion, which maybe you say this doesn't make sense. But I think a healthy skepticism is appropriate. I think being overly skeptical is bad on the side from the standpoint if you're doing too much defense. And if you simply are a scrivener and you write down whatever the injured worker tells them without filtering it through any of your medical judgment, then your reports are equally useless. You're doing what Michael says, the person who literally has 4 pounds of grip strength and yet can change their tire in your parking lot. There's something inconsistent about that. The person who says they can't lift their arm above their shoulder level, yet when they go to put their coat on, they go like that. And I've literally seen that in medical reports where doctors have said it. There's an inconsistency there. You can't put blinders on and say it doesn't exist. So you have to reconcile those kind of things. The QME evaluation, which we're going to still have quite a few of, a lot of AOEC QME evaluations are going to be an opportunity right now to market your skills and your credibility to particularly the claims people, but also to attorneys, because we're going to see those reports, and develop some kind of a reputation that allows you to move into the AME category. My own prediction is that in 2 to 3 years, the physicians who are doing AME work are not going to be in the QME list. There's going to be no point in paying the $500 to join, to pay for all the money to take the credits and do all that stuff, when you're already going to be booked out 2 years for doing evaluations, and you don't have to do QME evaluations where you have to open up your exam and report in 30 days. You have to get your report out within 30 days or you may not get paid. All those other things that go along with being a QME, the people who are well-established are going to drop out of that system. So I think that's where people want to be. And, of course, then the legislature will change it all in another year.
I'm curious. I'm curious about one thing. How many – I just want to go down the line. How many AME different AME doctors do you use in Northern California? Just go down the line. I'm just curious. How many do you use? Four?
Four or five?
Ten.
About ten.
That's not a lot. Because it's like, because if you look at it, I'm sure his four are probably the same here. So that's an incredibly narrow market that has great potential to expand. Yeah. So let's just do this. Let's have
Glenn, one quick comment.
A comment, a question, and then we're done. And then an answer to your question.
The last plea to you all, after you've had your exam, please get us the report as quickly as you can. I know you're busy, but please do, because it's generally taken us 6 months to get there, and everything is waiting. And if we need to take your deposition, don't book us a year out. It happens, and that's the biggest frustration. There are certain AMEs who other people will use that I won't, simply because if there's a question, and there often is, I need 1 hour of your time. And I know you've got 100 people saying that, but if you've done a report and you can't get me in a reasonable amount of time, if I have to wait 7 months to see you, 3 months for the exam, and a year for my questions, you've done me no good. My client's dead by the time we get there. So please find a way, if you've done this report, to let us finish it with that deposition. I know you may not want it, and I know by booking it a year away, a lot of times they go away, but it creates a problem.
Alex, I have a question about that. I personally dictate all of my reports with the patient there, and I try 90% of the time at the end to say the person, the applicant is here in the room and had a chance to correct me on these comments about their symptoms. Does that have any benefit from your point of view? It helps me, because otherwise they sit forever.
Absolutely,
if I don't
yes.
do it right away, it sits on my desk for months and everyone's unhappy.
Tremendous benefit, because the injured worker has an opportunity to kind of listen right. to what you just said.
I want them to know. I don't want someone coming back and being mad at me, and I want them to have a chance to say, my pain's severe, not moderate. You shouldn't say that.
Just a piece of feedback, I've had several of my clients say, gosh, the other doctor didn't even talk to me. He spent the entire time talking into a microphone. So there's a combination. I think there's value in dictating, because especially a lot of times doctors dictate the history and they want to make sure the person knows it. But there is a human side. Take the time to talk to them. Make sure they feel like they've been heard because it's a problem sometimes.
Fine. Sir.
Yeah, Mr. Marks, I guess I'm missing something. What's going to happen to QMEs over the next 2 years? You said they're going to disappear. What's going to happen within the next 2 years?
Yeah,
What?
Panel QMEs appointed by the system will still exist for unrepresented workers. Panel QMEs for represented workers for injuries on or after 1105 will still exist if the parties cannot agree on an AME. And panel and regular QMEs, adversary QMEs, will still exist as the inventory of old cases becomes a diminishing number for injuries prior to 1105, in which case the applicant is represented. But straight adversary QMEs chosen by one party or the other is a diminishing book of business over the next couple of years as cases where they are represented with injuries prior to 1105 diminish in number and percentage.
Okay, another second question. You took a poll, Glenn, of the panel. They all got 4 or 5. One fellow has maybe 10. What are we all here for if they've got everybody they want?
Well, no, what they said they're going to need there's not enough around.
Well, how many do you want? I mean,
I need 50.
They're going to need 40 or 50.
Right. You I got need 5? 50. Yeah. I got 5. I need 50.
And half.
So that's half the audience. You know, 40% of the audience can step
up
to the plate.
But what you have to understand is a great number of those the reason why it's down to this is because all of the others that we would also go to are booking a year out.
That's right.
These 5 I pick because at least I can get them to them within 6 months, and I consider myself lucky.
And the reason we need 50 right. each is because his 50 has to be the same as my 50, or else it doesn't work.
You didn't hear John's comment, which was the reason you're having the problem is that the reason you can do with the few you've got right now is because right now we have the right to go to an advocate QME. We're not going to have that right any longer very soon. And therefore, the stable of physicians who we consider honest, middle of the road, and credible is going to have to numerically increase astronomically order to do it.
Listen, we have to adjourn. They'll be here for a few minutes to ask. I just want to thank them so much. This is a volunteer effort on their behalf, and we should be very grateful.